Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 7th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Burning But Not Consumed, presented by Dorothy Bass.
Welcome to this session. My name is Dorothy Bass, and as you probably already know, I'm here in the village all summer coordinating the teaching staff. I've been inviting the teachers who are here and planning for this summer all year long, and actually longer than that, and it's a joy to me that it has begun, and begun so well. Come on in. Burn it, Bob. About to begin. And thanks for taking the time to come to this session. This week we're particularly thinking about standing on holy ground, and Dan and Larry have been raising some of the issues about holy ground in their sessions as well. You know, and I think that many of us feel this yearning to know creation as full of the presence of God, full of the glory of God, to join with creation as a human part of creation, and praising God as in Psalm 104. It seems to me, though, that one of the reasons that we often aren't able to do that or forget to do that is that we just don't have time. Last night I was talking to a young person in college who said, I try to live ecologically, but it's fast. It's easier when you're in a hurry and you have an exam and you have to go to your job and everything to take the fast food and the styrofoam, and you have to, you have to think about your time if you're going to live in the way that you want to live. Also, Larry's been talking about the holy ground of creation itself, and at the very end of the first creation account in Genesis 1 spills over a little bit into Genesis 2. After 6 days of creation, God says, and it was good. And then what does God do? God rests. But in a sense, Karl Barth said that in that resting, God was saying, this is good enough. There's no need to make any creature better than this, than these earth creatures I have just made. And the first, that day, that seventh day when God rests with creation, is a resting with, spending time with creation, not changing anything, using anything, just being with and hallowing that time. I've given lots of workshops on Sabbath and time in the last few years, and Margaret, I always start them with the story of an evening that we spent together 20 summers ago, probably about exactly 20 years ago. I know that because I was pregnant with my children at the time, and we were out to dinner with our husbands. All four of us are teachers, and it was a Friday night, a Saturday night, and it was lovely, lovely early spring evening, and we sat there and we groused, and we said, "Oh, tomorrow I have to grade a whole pile of papers. I have to give them back to my class on Monday. Oh, I have to grade 20. I have to grade 30. I have to grade 40. Well, I only have to grade 15, but they're really long. I have to get them in 2 months." So, and we were just kind of complaining, although I do wonder, and do you ever sit and talk, have people say, how are you doing? And so often the answer is, I'm really busy. Yeah. Now, are we complaining or are we boasting? I mean, do we have any value if we can't say that, right? And then it just suddly hit me, all four of us were churchgoers, and we were planning to go to church the next day, but here we were, on a Saturday night, basically sharing with one another our plans to ignore one of the Ten Commandments on the morrow. Okay, and if we had been saying, I think I'll bear false witness tomorrow, or I think I'll commit adultery tomorrow, or I think I'll steal something, it's not to say that we never have borne false witness or anything, but that we would know that something was wrong. We would know that something was wrong. And we become so used to being busy that we just talk about Sabbath in confirmation class when it means going to church. It doesn't necessarily mean resting. It means going to church. That's the last week kind of say about it. And it doesn't speak to us of deep rest with saying creation is good and this is good enough and let's spend time with it and with one another. Okay? So the theme of this session is talk about Sabbath and time and the kind of issues that you face and some of what I think the ways in which the deep resources of our faith tradition can be helpful to us in a time of real need about this, about time. Now, why is it that we have, let me offer a few facts and things, but then I want some experience out here too. Why is it that we have kind of blown off the idea of Sabbath as a culture? And even people who are really active in their churches are sometimes the busiest people, right? I mean, and going to church becomes something that you have to do, and you get there and set up, and you know. So why have we forgotten about this? I suggest three different things. One, there really is too much to do for most of us, for many people. Okay, it's not that we're workaholics necessarily. We'll get to that, but it's not just about that. There really is a distortion in what there is to do. There's an organization called Take Back Your Time. I don't know if you know them. Yeah, led by John DeGraff, who's the same man who did that film that some of us saw yesterday afternoon, Affluenza. And he talks about time poverty. And this is a book prepared by that. He's organizing a political movement nationally, interfaith, drawing in labor unions, policymakers, people who like pets, people who like children. I mean, getting them to think about time in our society. And part of their method is to have one day every October, I think it's October 24th, called Take Back Your Time Day. Take Back Our Time Day. And they do it on October 24th because the people who live in Western Europe and other similarly developed societies to our own, by October 24th, they have already done all the work that we're going to keep. They would get the rest of the year off. Okay, this society of ours, basically, after the Second World War, related to this Affluenza film we saw, we made a decision as a society, without even thinking about it, to take the increased productivity of our economy as stuff instead of as time. Instead of as healthcare, you know, instead of as justice, instead of lots of, we made a decision without thinking to take the incredible productivity of this economy in stuff, rather than to take it in some other way. And we could have made a different decision as a society. We did. Maybe somebody was doing this deliberately. It just kind of snuck up on most of us, with the help of advertisers and economists and so on. So most of us have opted into that. This is a wonderful book exploring, giving lots of facts and so on. Just a few very striking factoids from this same organization. Americans work an average of 9 full weeks, 350 hours, more per year than do European workers. And by the way, this is most true for sort of upper middle class professionals and the working poor, and in the demographic of people who have children, whether or not they have children, in that sort of in those middle years of life. But it affects almost everyone one way or another, except for those whose time is kind of cast aside as worthless, just as the person's cast aside in our society. I mean, those who are permanently unemployed or disabled and not haven't found a way to be drawn in. Okay, from 1973 to 2000, the average U.S. worker added an additional 199 work hours to his or her annual schedule. We could stay on the site while watching their benefits and health provisions diminish, right? Okay. Americans have by far the shortest paid vacations in the industrialized world, and 26% of Americans who work do not take any vacation at all. The average is down to something, I don't know, less than a week. America is the only country in the industrialized world that doesn't have a law guaranteeing paid vacation time. 80% of men and 62% of women put in more than 40 hours a week on the job. We work longer hours than medieval peasants did. Truly. Yeah. I mean, it's, we work longer than subsistence economies. Okay? Because we think we need more or something. And, okay, so that's one. And does that ring a bell for people? In your own lives, the lives of your children? All right.
And of course,
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to do it in the United States. I'm from Holland.
Oh, yes.
So I came to America and I had to get used to the American habits.
Yes.
But in Holland, you didn't have to do it.
No.
In Holland, they're just as prosperous as America.
That's right. That's right. Thank you.
But if I told my employer that I don't have to work 40 hours a week, I'm only going to work 30, I wonder if I'd have a job.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or health benefits or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's up. Mm-hmm. You know, universal health coverage would take us longer than this. But that, no, that's right. So it's a systemic problem.
Yeah.
So I don't want to say, that's why I don't want to say that first of all, it's a personal malformation. Though I think there are ways in which we'll get to that too. Okay.
I told my congregation I wasn't going to work 60 hours a week.
Uh-huh. What did they do? What did they say?
Some of them didn't like that.
Uh-huh. Why do you think that is? Why do you think they didn't like
that? Because they hadn't thought critically about it yet.
He said he told his congregation that he wasn't going to work 60 hours a week. You're a pastor. And they didn't like it because some of them really hadn't thought through what the meaning of that was in a critical way. Mm-hmm. And yet, before we're going in this session, I think there are few things in biblical ethics that are more clear than that God desires rest for us, mm-hmm. and that we need to help each other to claim that. I mean, it's just everywhere in biblical ethics. So we'll get to that. I've talked to many pastors who are people who serve the church in other ways professionally, whose Sundays are really going to be very busy. But I think it takes some teaching to get to that point of people who take the risk of coming in and saying, well, you know, do we really have to have meetings every night of the week? Mm-hmm. Could we consolidate these, meet less frequently? Okay, so we'll get to that. So too much to do. There really is too much to do. And there's some sociologists who study this, and they do as they should, if you count housework in, of course. There's even more to do. And some of that is really very essential, whether you live in a family, by yourself, with just one other person. You know, it's a really essential part of our livelihood. And it needs to be counted in these hours as well, so think about that.
But I have three garages to clean instead of one. That's right. In the 50s, there was only one.
Yeah. My husband is quite a wit. But one of our phrases at Holden over the years has been, I think it came from John Shrimp, maybe everyone uses this, live simply that others may simply live.
Mm-hmm.
And last week he said, you know, I think it's live simply that I may simply live.
Yeah.
You know, because it can get to you, right? Taking care of stuff, you have to maintain it. Okay, so this is an objective problem. Okay, and people from college, different societies have made different choices than ours has. Larry's talking tonight in his session about consumerism. It's so closely related, I just don't know if we're ever going to get going on the kind of lives we long for until we really learn to resist that. But resisting it with time, I'm going to suggest, is one of the ways. Okay, secondly, the time we do have, this is like an objective reality that's systemic, makes it hard to keep Sabbath. The time we do have is losing its shape. Think about it. Less than half the jobs in the economy are Monday to Friday daytime jobs. Okay? You can go shopping at any hour of the day.
Or night.
Or night. Yes. Day or night. I've talked to groups and talked to a bunch of people who work in the commodities exchange in Chicago. I mean, the worldwide economy is always humming. They have, you know, some of the people at the very top get to work during the day, but they've got not only cleaners coming in overnight, but they've got the clerical workers coming in overnight. in law firms all over the country. And they and the commodities markets are open in Japan when they're not open here. And you know, it's just to the point where they'll say, I can't take Christmas off because the the business is still humming on the other side of the world. Whew. Okay. So they're basically, I think that there's this, sometimes I imagine as a time which used to have some, you know, in any culture, it's not just about the good old days. In any culture, you sort of know that there's a time for certain things. You know, and this happens in different religious cultures and in different international cultures, and those boundaries are just really evaporating. You with me on this? So you can shop at any time, you can get entertainment at any time, and in fact, there's pressure from advertisers and from others to make use of all those different minutes. Okay? Does it make sense? So, you know, which means we're not setting aside a day of the week as a society. And I don't argue that we should. I think in a pluralistic society, you know, Christians don't need to ask the state to make this easy for us. But I think that resisting this as communities together is an important, you know, if we don't put down some anchors, we're just gonna be buffeted along by these social forces who wanna keep us busy every moment and shopping and being entertained, okay? It's kind of just, are you with me on this? About time having no shape? Mm-hmm. Okay. Any comments here?
Does the Sabbath or day of rest have to be a Sunday?
Well, let's get to that. I think it needs to be not just snatched in little pieces of bits in here and there, wherever you can find it. So I do reserve the word Sabbath for one day, which includes some of the biblical things we're going to talk about. However, I think that when we need to, everybody deserves a whole day, not just little bits and pieces. These bits and pieces would come real easy in this marketplace I just described. One more thing about that marketplace of there's a poet wrote a wonderful thing in the New Yorker magazine a few years ago. I think it's Nicole Oxenhandler was her name. She said there are two places in every town that are very similar with a neon. Now there are more of them, but neon lights and a pale clerk behind a desk and open all the time. The emergency room and the 7-Eleven. The 7-Eleven. And now there are other convenience stores. Okay, right? And we forget what is a real emergency. What do we really need and what do we really not need? You know, I mean, I have the munchies and it's 1 o'clock, where can I go? Now that's a different kind of need, and the kind of human need that calls us, you know, drives us to the emergency room. See what I mean? So that our whole sense of who we are and what we need gets distorted in this situation. Okay, that's the second. The third thing is a general speeding up of almost everything, and we're becoming habituated to fast responses. And there's one writer, indeed, who argues that, you know, we get adrenaline fixes from going real fast, whether it's on the thrill rides at the amusement parks or getting a fast video game or whatever, and we become habituated to this, and we simply feel lousy if we have to go slow. Well, you know, that's something to think about if we're going to think about caring for the earth and living, and you know, getting enough rest and being healthy. And you with me on this? I mean, it's a real issue. How many if any of you ever had this experience, and I have it, I have to say, frequently, you turn on the computer and it doesn't get going for a couple of seconds, you know, 4 seconds maybe. Josh, our computer guy's laughing. Yeah, and you kind of, and all of a sudden there's this rage just beneath the surface. Dan and Karin just got their first computer. They're looking scared here.
Have mercy on us.
Yeah. if you notice this tendency in yourself, beware. I think about this. Or you're behind somebody in the car, and the light turns green, and they don't go like the first second. And instead of thinking, you know, isn't this amazing? I'm planning to go all the way to another state today. You know, or isn't this amazing how far we can go, how fast? We think, do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I don't think we're supposed to be living like that as human beings, you know? Like always on the verge of rage that's somehow related to this adrenaline response. Does it make sense? Anybody want to tell any stories about that on themselves or, yeah?
There was a pastor in my synod who never had a computer, wrote everything by typewriter, and he sent a letter to the bishop, it was actually his resignation letter, with a typewriter. And the bishop's response was, wow, you still type with a typewriter. You must have saved a lot of time over the years. It's really true. Uh-huh. Yeah. I still take as long to write a letter. I might rewrite it 5 times and print out 5 copies of it,
but
it doesn't really save me any time.
Right. And it habituates you to this instant response. Yeah, that's great, thank you. Yes?
Don't think that when you retire, you're going to have more time. Just goes.
Do you agree? Yes. Others are agreeing?
First place, you're not moving quite as fast.
Sometimes I say that I think people my age, and I'm about probably 10 years before retirement, act like we can save up all our Sabbaths until then.
Yeah.
And this is not a good strategy for at least 2 reasons. One is that once you get there, there are other things still to do. But the other thing is we cannot count on living that long. We cannot, and that is, I really think the reason we're gonna get into some theology now, but there are some fundamental mistakes about who we are as human beings that are embedded in this way of living in time, you know? Some fundamental assumptions about our capacity to master the world and time, which are simply false, and which we need to think about. Yes.
Another idea here too. Like we know this week's gonna be super busy, but we think always 2 weeks from now it'll calm down. We'll have more time then.
Uh-huh.
We have a false perception of predicting
what
the time's gonna be like.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And yes, please, Marie.
Years ago, we used to be able to take free seminars before our Husky football games, which my husband thought was the best part of it.
Uh-huh.
But I went to one on sleep by a nurse specialist in sleep, and she said, we are more apt to have an accident from somebody sleep deprived than drunk.
Yes. And I think we're going to be seeing more about this in public health in the coming years. A lot of research going on. And we are a very sleep-deprived society. And young people, I think, high school is just a terrible time with all of this. We make them get up at the crack of dawn, even though their body clocks are permanently fixed in a different way hormonally, which they truly, there was research on this. But we want them there to be working at McDonald's at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, or playing sports. And that's more important. And there were some communities in Minnesota, always a progressive state, they decided to use the school buses after taking the elementary and junior high school kids and to let the high schoolers start at 9 o'clock. And their SAT scores went up 100 points with no other changes. Okay, because they actually were learning for this. Yeah, it's really interesting. So, and Connecticut is considering this. There are studies on this. It's really amazing. And we put them in this situation where the bells are always ringing. You know, it's kind of, so it's very, very interesting to keep them busy. Okay, well, which reminds me. Okay, now that's a segue to the public schools and how I have a little prop here, my low-tech multimedia presentation, my data book, okay? My data book. And I just told you, kind of bad for next year. It's empty for October. Isn't that great? In Valparaiso Public Schools, it's a county seat town in Northwest Indiana. In fourth grade, every student is supposed to get a date book like this.
Okay. Fourth grade?
Fourth grade. Now, I'm happy to say that they did not really use them. Because they just wouldn't. At least my kids didn't, and they passed fourth grade. So, but then in ninth grade, they give them another one, which is the fourth grade was supposed to go out to a store and buy one like this. I mean, it doesn't have to be leather, but you know. So. But then in ninth grade, they get another one, which has all the football games and things on it, and the meetings and the days off. And the only way you could get a bathroom pass was to get it signed onto that book. So if you forgot that book, you don't get a kind of all. And I've checked around. There are other, when I do workshops, there are other people. Any other stories like that? That gets
confirmed? My children, once you get into 10th grade, they have an assignment book that's given to each high school.
Right.
And that's just for their homework, which is a really nice idea.
Yeah. Yes.
But it's nothing like this. There's nothing tagged to it.
Okay. That's great. Okay, it's a really nice idea, isn't it? I mean, we do need to learn to organize our time. Yeah. And I really, you know, I really value this thing. I haven't switched to a Palm Pilot. Probably my presentations are way out of date by now. But no, I mean, I really need this. It's really good for some things. And that's part of the response to doing better with our time, I think, is to learn to manage it to a certain extent and to keep track of things. That's good. This is helpful. And there are some people who will teach you workshops where they teach you all these techniques for putting things in priorities and using this, and that's fine. I'm going to argue it doesn't get to the heart of the matter, but it's a good thing. And it's part of the answer. That's one. Political and social organization, learning from Holland, all of that, that's number two. But I also want to suggest that there are spiritual and theological forms of understanding that we need to come to if we're going to really address this in our lives. Now think about a date book. And one thing that, I don't like what it suggests about how we need to get our children to live, but the more important thing is, what does this tell me about what time is? Time is a bunch of empty boxes. And I stand above it, and I can control it. I'm outside of it. And it's just a metaphor, but you know, basically, I'm valuable if I can put in a lot of things on these boxes. And I'm not valuable if I can't. Okay? And I'm outside of it, and I'm not really subject to time, second mistake, because I am subject to time. You know, I get older. I don't know how many more days I have left. Right? I am very much subject to a time like an ever rolling stream soon bears us all away. We fly forgotten as the night, as a dream flies at the opening days. Is that right? From Isaac Watts's hymn. I mean, that is a truth about time. And we do not stand above it. It is not flat and empty. We're not just supposed to fill it up to make ourselves important. But we are within it. Now let's think, let me suggest that there are some spiritual and theological things going on. I'm already getting there. I mean, our finitude is one fact about ourselves. And I don't think we can go much further even with Sabbath unless we're willing to say we're not going to get it all done. We're not going to get everything all done in our lives over the long term or even maybe today. I'll do this as soon as I get everything done. I'll take some time off. Well, you know, I think that's probably not going to happen. The other thing, I mentioned our rage, but isn't there also kind of an anger towards others that comes out in our living this fast way? Those people who fritter away their time. You know, the people who are always late. You know, this is like the major moral sin in the family to which I'm married, being a little bit late. Now, there's a degree of consideration to others and so on, but it seems to be above other kinds of sin, the kind of blame. And that's a small thing compared to thinking that those who don't use their time well, as we would think, to do certain kinds of things, are deserve to be down unsuccessful in the world, and so on. Okay. So there's blame, there's rage. Oh, how about despair? You know, guilt. I can't. You know, I didn't do this. I didn't do this. I'm a terrible person. Right? Guilt. And the sense that comes with the way we live in time that the way to respond to that guilt is to do more. Right? To work harder, it sounds like justification by works a little bit. We just, is our value in how much we accomplish? Now, it's wonderful that we that there's a lot that gets accomplished and so on, but to put that kind of value on it, I think is not what we're called to do. And so, let me see if this is ringing a bell for people. And yes.
Well, it's often reinforced every time we. If you go into a gathering of people that you haven't met very often, you say, "What do you do? Where do you work?"
Yes. Yes.
And you know, for people that aren't working or for whatever reason, very often that you know, you find some way to answer that in a way that encourages value.
Right. Right. Right.
So.
Right. Good. Thanks. Anybody else? Is this ringing a bell?
Is anybody else irritated with people with PDAs, which we don't have yet? We probably will, but they're a friend, and they always act open as though, oh yes, when would you like to meet? And they always have the PDA, and no, I can't meet them. No, you know, and they have good intentions, but you look at the little device of which is organizing their time. And you think there's no time for you.
Yeah.
Oh, I can fit you in between.
Yeah. That can happen with this too.
Yeah, I can.
And how do you know when it's, you know, when just as a loving person going about your life and somebody comes to you right now with a need, you know, when does that, I think people over the years, we learn to respond in one way or another. But, right? I mean, there's the planning ahead. There's also the, are you, in what sense are we called to be available now? It's hard. Partly because we don't want to admit that we're finite, I think.
What about penciling in? I'll pencil you in.
Yeah.
So we can erase it if maybe.
Yeah. Something better.
Yeah.
Or you use it as an excuse. Let me check my calendar and I'll get back in touch with you.
Yeah.
Which frees up a lot of time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
Well, so far I haven't heard anything that they are having a hard time with it. They kind of complain of it, but they want the money check just the same. I haven't heard yet that they say, well, how can we organize that we can take the Sabbath day for the Sabbath? Mm-hmm. No, I haven't heard it yet.
What do you think? Do you think that there is pain out there, or am I making this up? Maybe not about the Sabbath day, because I think that's all that's going on.
No, it's Sunday, but Sunday still comes in pretty handy.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But in our lives, anyhow.
Yeah. So you haven't heard complaints. Have the rest of you heard complaints?
I complain.
You complain.
Yes. My children work on holidays because they get double pay.
Mm-hmm.
And so they can't come at Christmas and at holiday times, you know. And maybe if you're lucky, they'll come the week before or after.
Yeah.
But my son said to me, we don't want to be poor like you and Dad are when we get old.
Yeah.
And I never thought of myself as being poor. But to him.
Yeah, right.
And now my granddaughter is working.
Uh-huh.
On the holiday.
At what age?
Well, she's just started college.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And we often it's the most vulnerable people, the youth workers, the young people, those who are poor and who are working several jobs to make ends meet, who end up having very little control over their schedule. Yeah.
It seems to me that as I hear people talk, this isn't a problem that can be solved by one person going into your boss and saying, I'm not going to work on Christmas or Mother's Day. It's a political decision that has to be made.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as we think of freedom as being able to have your store open whenever you want it to, and being able to have your worker there whenever you want it to, then we'll go on in this way.
Yeah.
If we start saying, it's everyone's right to have a holiday, to have a vacation, then we'll do it in another way.
Right. Yeah. What is freedom?
That doesn't make sense, because there's still people that have to support. On Christmas Day, somebody had to cook meals here. As much as
right. That's right.
follows that. So right? just make those kind of pronouncements. It makes sense. Right. Somebody better be in the hospital.
That's right.
On
that's
Christmas
right.
Day.
That's absolutely right. Yeah.
And no, we'll get to. Had to readjust our holiday schedule because most of our holidays are have a religious background, like Christmas, Thanksgiving, and we have a pastor, you know, daughter who's a pastor, so she can't come on those days. So we've just had to readjust our schedule.
Right. But see, again, this it's going to be communal, not just individual. It's going to have to be the whole community figuring this out in a way that is fair and helpful. That's what we're going to get to. It's not. I don't think it's going to be about setting down certain times when nobody should work. But it's going to be about fairness and figuring that out as a community. Yeah.
Well, we have in Dallas, Texas, at the mall, something that you're referring to, the systemic change where Chick-fil-A is closed on Sunday.
Right, but then, you know, that's an example. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I come from a family where my father had to work on holidays. My husband quite often had to work on holidays. My son has to work on holidays most of the time. But if a family knows that in advance, you can have Christmas on the 22nd or whenever and have your family gathering then and then those who are around on the 25th and go to church.
Yeah.
It can be worked out. We never celebrated holidays on the right day. My whole family.
We're going to have to be, everybody's going to have to be supple with
yeah,
this.
You have
everybody's
to
going to have
set
to be
aside
supple.
A time, but not right. necessarily the time everybody else does.
So there's but there's several different stages here. One is this incredible social problem, you know, and then there are ways of dealing with it. But when we, part of the question is suppose that we as in families or in congregations decide to try harder on Sabbath and this kind of thing. How then do we also see that as a social justice issue for those who are not part of our little family and not part of our congregation, but who are, you know, over at Walmart slaving away all the time and still not being able to go to the doctor? You know, how do we deal with that, I think, as part of the, I mean, it becomes part of our overarching life of trying to be people of justice in the world. Yes.
Hearing people like Tony, I think we have to define what's called and what's a driving force for us is called the American Dream. Mm-hmm. It's a very potent and very powerful thing. Mm-hmm. And what we put into that, and it probably it's been the driving motive for what's made this country what it is, mm-hmm. and what did Tony come over here for? You know, and so forth. He was in pursuit, you know, of that thing. Mm-hmm. And I often think that it's valued and still idolized around the world.
Well, you want an answer to that? Yeah, Dave.
No.
You know, yeah. Sure, I came from Holland to America. Mm-hmm. And I thought America was living by the Monroe the theory. America had a border with Mexico, and America had a border with Canada, and there was the Pacific Ocean, and on the other side there was the Atlantic. And I thought, well, I don't have to worry about what Germany will let me grow, in we were growers, or France, or Germany, or England, all the other countries. America, I can just be in America. And the first thing, of course, America was knocked on the door by the Brits and said, come and help us. We have World War I to fight and we need you. And the next thing was, of course, World War II came and we didn't even, and they came not only when the countries in Holland or Europe got really hungry about and needed help, they already came by before we even started, and the Americans already had to start coming in with more help for the countries in Europe. And but now, we say now, we want to make sure in the United States that we don't have to worry about terrorists. And we're going to go and knock the Irish people in Ireland. and we will knock those people over. We, the Americans, are going to fight for the whole world that we are still Americans. Freedom. We are creating this whole situation.
Yeah. Thank you.
We started nice and small. Mm-hmm. And now, all global.
Yeah. That's right. No, that's true. There's no escaping the whole global situation out.
And that is what we apparently like.
Yeah.
So don't blame you. Don't blame you for it.
Right.
We like it that way.
The question before, thank you very much. I think what the, part of the question is here is whether the church has some wisdom or some help, which is not going to perhaps take over the whole society right away, but can be ways, forms of communal resistance to a way of life that is very, is not good for the earth, that is overstressful for those who participate in, and that is not bringing true freedom to ourselves or to the rest of the world. Does that make sense? Can we resist? Can Sabbath? And I'm not trying to put. I think there are different ways that to approach this or other ethical questions. One would be to say, "Okay, we're going to really do it. Nobody does anything on Sundays. That's it. You know, nobody does anything on these. Make a real law and lay it on and separate." But you know, Seventh Day Adventists have done this for some time. Right. Or other groups that were very Orthodox Jews. Okay.
People in Utah.
Okay, yes, to have a whole different calendar we live by, and never mind the rest of the world. That's one possibility. Another one is to totally accommodate, and to say, you know, come to this church. We're right next to the mall, and you can go out. You know, you can go out afterwards, or bring your family. We'll fix your car at the same time, and we promise you the services will never be longer than 35 minutes. Right? I mean, you can kind of accommodate, fit into this pattern as well as you can. You know, religious services available at every hour. That's kind of getting there, but to accommodate to the situation. The third would be, and this is what I kind of favor, is really thoughtful resistance, thoughtful putting down of some anchors that will help us to know who we are and to serve others well, and perhaps to be salt and yeast in the world to help others who are not part of our Christian communities to see the lower Christians by our law. You know, the lower Christians, because we're not just going crazy all the time trying to, catch up with the Joneses. And I think that some of what Larry's called the deep traditions of our faith can help us to think about how to do that in our different local communities. One of those is Sabbath. And let's, how much time we have. I think it is worthwhile to hear the commandments, the Sabbath commandment, and to hear it as, I like to say, as a gift, not just law, but as gift. And by the way, in a sense, Jesus says, "Come unto me, all you who labor and heavy burden, and I will give you rest." And resist those who want to make the Sabbath a real legal kind of thing, obviously, in some of these changes in the Gospels, while also always going to the synagogue on Sabbath and observing Sabbath in some ways. But, and in a sense, I think about that and think of those, as you mentioned, the people who make it possible for others to enjoy that Sabbath. I mean, it's a huge gift. I mean, that's what Jesus is doing, is making it possible for those around him who he's healing to receive the gift of genuine rest and healing, which Sabbath also offers. And so I say thank you to those who serve the church professionally and in other ways, helping the rest of us to enjoy that. Okay, first of all, look, it's Exodus 19, isn't it? 19 to 20? And this is a familiar thing. Is, I don't know if you realize this. I didn't until I started doing this work. Exodus 20. The Sabbath commandment is the only one that appears two different ways in Scripture. Do you know that? Mm-hmm. What we're supposed to do is the same, but the reason for it is different, significantly different. And it's the only significantly different in the two times that the commandments are in there. It's the only significant difference between them. So that's kind of interesting. So would someone read Exodus 20, 8 through 11? Would you?
Okay.
Thank you.
Remember the Sabbath and keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. You shall not do any work, you, your son or your daughter, your male or female slave, your livestock, or the alien resident in your towns. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that's in them, but rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and consecrated it.
Thank you. Okay, so what is the active part? What are we supposed to do or not do?
Work.
Not work. Right. So notice there are 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. Your work is valued as part of God's creation, but 6 days. And on the other day you shall not do any work. And who else shall not do any work?
Animals,
slaves, your children, your livestock, the alien residents, the resident aliens, you can't, you know, import laborers to do it for you, okay? But a whole, an image of total social, corporate rest, not just me personally taking a nap, but also me personally taking a nap, right? A whole society at rest, imagine, wow. And one of the old rabbinic tales over the centuries has been that if ever the Jewish people kept one Sabbath perfectly, then the Messiah would come. And so it's not a matter of perfect, but what an image. Think of it as corporate rest, not just for me, but also for those who are even the most oppressed in the society, right? Those who are poor animals. This is the one that's in the catechism, I believe, and it has to do with consecrating and blessing, and it does get us to church. But it's also got this social, big social dimension, which is important. Let's listen to the other one, which is in Deuteronomy 5, starting at verse 12. Mark, go ahead, the same reader would be fine if you'd like to.
Observe the Sabbath day and keep it holy as the Lord your God commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. You shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter or your male or female slave, or your ox or your donkey or any of your livestock, or the resident aliens in your town, so that your male and female slave may rest as well as you. Remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out from there by a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day.
Do you hear that difference? Mm-hmm. The same instructions, but now what's the different reason?
Because you were liberated.
Uh-huh. Yeah, remember that you were a slave. Mm-hmm. Remember that you were a slave. And there are lots of kinds of slavery, I think, as we bring this forward in, you know, 3 millennia later. Remember that you were a slave, but the Lord your God led you out with a mighty hand. You know, and that in every Sabbath there is that remembrance of liberation. And I would argue also a call to be about liberation. Perhaps also an acknowledgement that if we're going to be doing that, we need to get some rest as well.
We can't rest on the Sabbath because we've given up the slaves.
Well, even here, though, we weren't going to count on the slaves to do the job, were we? Yeah.
I think one of the other interesting differences between the two accounts is that in the first one in Exodus, it reminds us of almost the nuclear family, the community that lives within your walls. And in the other one, it extends it to the resident aliens of the town.
Huh.
And so it says community is more than just your home.
Yes.
And you've been your particular farm or your particular business.
Yeah.
And you have to be sensitive to that too.
Yeah. It's an interesting difference, isn't it? I kind of think of it as the creation reason for Sabbath and the liberation reason for Sabbath. And actually, you know, if you're trying to get to the heart of Torah, of Jewish Hebrew thought, creation and Exodus. And that's kind of right at the heart of the whole thing. And very important still today to Jewish identity. And in a way that I find very inspiring. Let's talk about some practical ideas. First, I do want to say a word. I'm still conflicted about, theologically, about the seventh-day Sabbath, the first day, new creation, eighth day, Lord's Day, which is Sunday. And for many, many centuries, almost all Christians have put those together. I decided to go with the flow. You know, to be historic about that. But I'm not theologically altogether comfortable with that. So that's what I have tried to do, and to link this celebration of creation and liberation also to Christ's resurrection, which brings freedom of yet another and transcending kind, and to try to anchor that somewhere near that remembrance and celebration of the resurrection. But let's talk about some ideas for how to get that day. I think, does it have to be Sunday? I think that historically it's so exciting to me that for, 2,000, however many weeks it is, since 2,000 times 52 weeks, you know, people have been gathering on that day of resurrection to eat and tell stories together. I think that is a wonderful thing, which I hope to not move that around too much, although I favor making it as available to people at different times as possible. But the day off can't always be that way. And indeed, the early Christians would go to work on that first day of the week and then gather in the evening for that meal. So I don't think we need to be rigid about that. I think it's a matter of being adaptive. But suppose that we really started trying to help each other take a day of deep rest. What would that look like? What could that mean?
No excuses. Mm-hmm. You know, you could go right across the border here to Canada, and they have the Sunday for the Sunday. Mm-hmm. And they stop at 6 o'clock at night during the week. Mm-hmm. So the families can have dinner together. Mm-hmm. That is right in Canada. You don't even have to go to Europe.
Okay.
It's right with your neighbor. Mm-hmm. But the pressure is coming from the United States that we have to have it just like the United States.
Yep. Yep.
That is what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can still see before I die, I bet you the Canadians have forgotten now about that Sunday.
Uh-huh, uh-huh, very interesting. There's some global pressure, isn't there, Josh?
Well, something that I think would be sort of helpful is if employers thought of, or anybody really, if you think of someone working on their day off as something bad to sort of reprimand them for, rather than saying, oh good, you worked on your day off, good for you. Because we reward people who break the Sabbath rule, and yet we want people to be rested and good workers, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting, yeah.
One thing I admire about Latin cultures, and even in Europe, is the fact that not only do they have the Sabbath on Sunday, every day for 2 hours, everything shuts down, they go home, have dinner with their families, and take a nap, and then go back to work.
Yeah.
To me, that's fantastic.
This is also under pressure, though, from the global economy as well. There's an article recently about Spain in the New York Times about how they're going to lose their siesta.
One of the reasons that we don't probably observe anything like that anymore is a real definite movement in this country to destroy the unions. And the unions are the ones that had the power at that time to give workers these benefits.
Yes. If you think of how the blood and the sweat and the that was shed for a 40-hour work week in this country. Mm-hmm. And it's gone. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. Yeah.
I suspect that is why
the European Union Constitution is going down in France and went down in the Netherlands. I suspect that may be the one of the reasons why.
Because it doesn't safeguard those limited mm-hmm. hours of work. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. I have a friend who's American who's working for a bank in France who's not allowed to work more than 35 hours. Yeah. 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 There it is. That's it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Our local clinic in Billings, I asked her, one of the radiologists, you know, who's going to be reading this? Do I have a personal interest in who's going to read this well, you know, on a scan? And he said, well, don't worry about it. He said, they're in Australia.
Yeah.
And they have a link. You let somebody else, you trust mm-hmm. that somebody else is working mm-hmm. when you're sleeping.
Very good.
You trust that
yeah.
God is caring.
Good, yeah.
You know, there's a Sabbath always someplace. And uh-huh. And so they link cooperative with the gift of science and technology, instantaneous digital communication, mm-hmm. clear so that the Australians can read the test and then they read for the Australians their night.
Uh-huh. That's a human version of another point that I love, which I'll just mention on this whole theology of time. Biblical days. Think of Genesis 1. Began when?
Sundown.
Sundown, right? And it was evening and it was morning the first day. It was evening and it was morning the second day. And Eugene Peterson, a wonderful writer, points out that what this means is when we get up, God's already been doing most of the work for half the day. Right? I mean, the crops have been growing before the farmer starts digging with the hoe. The wound has been healing before the physician gets to the office, right? And then similarly now, we think of our work not as cranking it up, but as joining in. And this helps over the finitude of our lifetimes as well. We're joining in to ongoing work across the centuries of ministry, or of farming, or of caring for the land, or of serving others. I mean, there's a whole, across the centuries, we come and we do our part, and then we pass it on to whoever's next. You know, it's joining on a daily basis, but also across the course of our lifetimes. Other ideas or suggestions for?
Well, the question for me, or that I've heard sometimes is, so we've chosen the day that we're going to observe the Sabbath, and what are the parameters of what we do with it? I mean, for me, gardening would be absolute work uh-huh. and yard work. But there are people that really, really enjoy that. It's restful for them. So what
do you think?
I think out of this, anything that really gives you pleasure and relaxes you, I was thinking of my daughter, and mm-hmm. the only time she really has off is Sunday afternoons. Mm-hmm. She works 6.5 days. Mm-hmm. And to get in her garden and yeah. mess around, that is therapy.
I agree. Yeah.
So,
yeah, I don't think this is a law for us. I think it's a gift.
I think it is too. It's something that you really enjoy.
To receive it that way. One thing that I've done now for almost 20 years is to abstain as much as possible from the consumer economy mm-hmm. on Sundays. And to not go in stores.
Right.
Not look at catalogs, not balance my checkbook or do my income taxes, things like that. I mean, I really try very hard to do that. Now, there are other things, but on the other hand, you know, we have two family subscriptions, one to the Chicago Shakespeare Theater, one to the Chicago Symphony on Sunday afternoons. You could say that's a consumer item and it did cost money, but, well, that's different.
So
it's the same kind of principle. I don't know.
Jesus is going to say, so you went to the symphony.
Yeah. Right, I mean, that's been the way that we've worked it out.
Now, so you're not bringing something home you have to store. You're going and you're enjoying something, and so that's, as far as I'm concerned, that's different.
I mean,
and I don't cook on Sundays either.
Uh-huh. Yeah, thank you.
Well, just thinking about the orchestra and
theater,
yeah,
the people who perform in those are both called players.
Great.
In some respects, maybe they're, it's different for that reason.
No, I think play is great. I think play is great. I just hope they get another day off a week, and I think they do. I think play is great. Even John Calvin used to go bowling on Sunday afternoons. I mean, I think recreation. I would say church picnics, yes, you know, with shared labor. Business meetings, no. You know, hikes, yes, for those who like them. Business meetings, no.
What about the sports? The professional football teams, that they play at 11 in Denver. Church attendance is down to the late service. You go to the early service if you're going to go at all.
What do you think?
The kids' leagues, a lot of the soccer leagues and things, are on Sundays.
Sunday mornings.
Mm-hmm.
There's a town, I hear we're talking Canada again.
They're playing.
I was doing a workshop on this with some pastors in Michigan. There was a couple from Canada, and they had gotten all the churches together very ecumenically for a hockey league that met that wouldn't play on Sundays. And there were so many people in this area that were involved, and that it became the preferred league, and they prevailed. But I know that, you know, the littlest kids get the ice at the worst time in other parts of the upper Midwest. And it's a matter of discernment. Though even for those, there's so many parents who worry about this, and I think, and it's a real issue. My personal, I mean, the way I would handle it, I guess, is to the thing I don't like about youth sports is sometimes it's more fundraising, and it's more driving, and it's more all the things besides play that take away the pleasure from it. And there are few kids who deserve those traveling trips and really need them. And there are a lot of kids who'd be happier playing at a level that's more sustainable, I think, but I don't know. Are there other thoughts about that?
We have a mentor, a couple that moved to live quite close to where we were living. And they have been such a blessing to us. We have tried to follow in their footsteps. But what was remarkable about these people was that they had 5 children, spread over 16 years, I think. And she went to school. She became a teacher. She was teaching. And those people always, always had time.
Hmm. And they ate together.
Mm-hmm. They, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you. I sometimes think that what our tradition can help us to do with worship, the rhythms, we didn't talk about the rhythms of the day, which can include bedtime prayer, which really is an acknowledgement of our finitude. We have to rest in God's mercy overnight. Who knows if we'll wake up tomorrow? No, we rest in mercy and to allow ourselves to sleep. Let go of the sins of the day, receive forgiveness, start again. Thanks for food. I mean, little rhythms that we put in place that remind us of who and whose we are. Thanks for food rather than always the grab and run, grab and run. Weekly rhythms of worship and annual rhythms of worship, which also not only shape our time, that's the secondary effect, but remind us of who we are and what this is all about. And I think help us to embrace our finitude with joy rather than with dread and resignation. I think I need to bring this session to a close. I'd be happy to talk further with anybody who wishes to. I've written a book on this topic called Receiving the Day, and which is in the bookstore, and there's also Take Back Your Time, which has a lot of suggestions, and is much more oriented towards political and social organizing around this topic. It was really just as the labor movement did that politically and socially. I think we need to do that as well. Japan, by the way, 15 years ago decided they were having all this suicides and everything from the people who were overworked. They made a social political decision to stop that. And now we work way more than they do. We work harder than the Japanese by a good bit. Okay? So it's a social political matter which we need to address, I think, both in our communities of worship and socially.
The Christianity of the day issue with their has an incredible one.